Year 2057. Chapter 19. January 2057. In the last week of an extraordinary January, Tash Brand more or less ordered the in-jokes to put aside their demanding schedules and get together properly, well, over their phones, for the first time since the blink, as opposed to swapping occasional scrappy messages. Even if Wu Shi could only show up virtually, courtesy of a link from a microgravity rehab facility at Euston, where he had been taken on landing from the lodestone. Tash herself was stuck here in Manners for now, in her government-funded flat, into which she had moved her father, Noel, since Blink Day. But living within walking distance of Government House helped a lot, and she wasn't about to tell him so, but in the fallout from the blink, her dad's help with such irrelevances as meals and laundry had been invaluable. Mel Kapoor, meanwhile, had been brought back to England in the wake of Charlie Marlowe, and on this particular night, Mel had asked if she could bring along Charlie too. To Marlowe's chagrin, both were stranded in Newcastle, some way from their home observatory in Yorkshire, and still, frustratingly, unable to get any significant science done of their own. Indeed, Tash, Mel and Charlie had another meeting to attend later that evening. The problem was that Marlowe's very visible role on Blink Day had elevated her to the status of a kind of celebrity advisor to the English government and its allies, on the blink and all manner of related science phenomena. And Tash had seen a lot of her, and so of Mel. While they had plenty to advise about, the whole world was data gathering, it seemed, trying to figure out what just happened. Government centres like House were sinks of expertise and knowledge, to which experts of all kinds were summoned, inasmuch as there were any experts about such an event as the blink, Tash supposed, in advance of more hierarchies of international consultations. Ultimately, maybe they would even take some action. And meanwhile, off in the shadows, Tash knew, other groups were organising too. The conspiracy theorists, the millennial prophets and their followers, the bunker builders. A whole new meme set had been inserted into humanity's paranoid soul. As the last of the January sunlight bathed the house, they finally sat down together, Tash, Mel, Charlie, in the flat's tiny lounge, while Noel fussed around in the kitchen making tea. As for Mel's daughter Jane, she generally seemed mysteriously to discover overdue homework assignments whenever her mum's old fart friends got together, and she was sleeping over with a school friend. And here was Wu Shi, even, a big image projected from Houston thrown on a wall screen, showing him to be locked into a full gravity support exoskeleton that didn't whir too loudly. For a moment, there was peace, calm, togetherness. This was what it was about, for Tash. In times of angst, her instinct was always to gather, to nurture. Even just to hug, damn it. Even if only remotely. But any traces of serenity on Shi's face were fleeting. The grief, the anger, were all too raw. Everybody was still following the travails of the surviving crew of the Almirich. After the blink, with sunlight restored, and power flowing through the spacecraft's systems again, at least the immediate danger to life had been averted. Now the crew were struggling to get their craft back on a new Earth rendezvous course, using their emergency measures solar sail to compensate for the 24 hours of drift they had suffered on Blink Day. The various national space agencies were cooperating, putting together contingency rescue plans in case of under- or over-correction with this clumsy improvisation. And the astronauts themselves had completed what examinations of Jim's body they could manage before paying their own respects. 5 days ago, Tash had come home with her father to watch the final bleak, unreal-seeming ceremony that followed. The whole world, it seemed, had watched as the airlock hatch had finally been opened and the body wrapped in an improvised shroud had been consigned to a sunlight that no longer seemed friendly or eternal. It had all looked like some movie special effect to Tash. She knew that amid the global trauma of Blink Day, there had been a handful of high-profile deaths like this that had particularly grabbed wider attention. It was always this way, at times of national disaster or terrorist outrage or pandemics. You sought symbolic deaths of the hero medics, the bereft children, the serene elderly who had seen so much before. This time it was Jim Boyd, lost Mars astronaut, symbolising a whole damaged planet. As for she, Tash had heard hints that Serena Jones herself had commandeered a ship, one of her corporation's wholly owned experimental craft, to bring she, Jim's fiancée, down quickly from the lodestone's quiet watch in the renewed shadow of the Earth. Tash had felt unworthy, as she speculated that maybe Jones was just seeking some favourable publicity. But maybe there was a nobler motive. Since then, there had been hints of she's participation in some new projects of Jones's. If so, she hadn't said a word, not even to the in-jokes. And, probably, Mel and Tash had glumly concluded, not to his own family, of whom there only seemed to be his mother, herself, apparently, a formidable space scientist, still based in China, called Wu Yang. The only time the other in-jokes had ever met her, or rather glimpsed her, was when she had shown up in the wake of their notorious cadet training near-death experience. And even then, she seemed to be there to check in on Shi's health, to berate him coldly at his stupidity for getting in such a mess, and to rail at the supervisors of the test, as opposed to comforting her son. Now, as the Almirik inquiries unwound, she had watched helplessly, Tash knew, and grieved silently for his fiancée. Well, here he was today, with them all, if only for a while, if only in spirit. And if the in-jokes were all the true family she had, she was glad he was here. But even so, he seemed distracted to Tash, as if he had some ulterior reason even for joining this little gathering. The apartment block creaked and swiveled, as the last January sunlight, low but strong through the windows, shifted. Charlie Marlowe looked around, amused. My parents owned a house like this, an early smart wood build. Always turning like a flower to the sun. I guess we're used to it, Tash said. We had a place like this before, years ago, when my mother died. The 39 pandemic, Noel called from the kitchen. Then, after Dad retired from the security business, and I started working in house, government house, I moved here. This estate was part of the redevelopment of much of the region, when they moved the government up here, and I didn't have a lot of choice. I think we quite like it, though. Nostalgic. 2030 chic. Never got used to it myself, Marlowe said, being shifted around every couple of hours of daylight. Maybe that's the astronomer in you, Mel said with a smile. You need a sense of your own orientation in space and time. Marlowe snorted. And you need to spend less time with pop psychology journalists, as on Skythrust. What babble. I'm prone to seasickness, as you may have observed on that flying toy, and that's a lot more likely explanation. Tash was aware that she was not contributing. Behind his screen, he looked blankly from one face to another, as if they were talking some unknown language. Noel came bustling in with a tray of teacups, a pot, a jug of whitener. Sorry to take so long, he said as he sat the tray down on a small central table. Damn food printer on the blink again. Government issue tat. Tea for everyone. Good to meet you, by the way, Astronomer Royal. She smiled back. Only the King calls me that, Mr. Brand. I'm Charlie. I'm Noel, then. Noel Brand. Very good to meet you, anyhow. Marlowe eyed him. Noel, huh? I'm guessing we're around the same age. Wrong side of 60. And is there a trace of a Manchester accent? My parents were Britpop fans too. He sat. Ha! Guilty as charged. Not that it ever meant anything to me. Old folks' music? I grew up on Korean pop. Remember that? No, Dad, said Tash with mock weariness. Noel swiveled toward She's image, making a visible effort. Tash saw to include him in the conversation. Maybe you'd know some of that stuff. The K-pop classics. I once saw Blackpink live. Oh, Dad. No, it is fine, she said dryly. China and Korea are, after all, in the same hemisphere. Easily confused. but I was never a fan of such elderly music. Impulsively, Mel reached out towards his screen, pulled back her hand. Always too serious, huh, she? The screen relayed the soft sound of a ringtone. She stared down, presumably at a phone out of shot. Then, with a stiff, formal smile, he said, I apologise. I've set the alert level to significant only. Of course, that does depend on your definition of significant. Tash sensed the tension among the rest of the group, as Mel, even Noel, almost visibly longed to check their own phones. What now? All save Marlowe, in fact, who sipped her tea serenely. That's the skill of it all right. At a time like this, plenty of facts coming in, of one kind or another, and non-facts. The trick is to identify what's true, let alone significant, and to use that to make sensible guesses. All in order to brief the politicians, which will be the fate of Tash and myself in... She checked her watch. Tash tried to reassure her. We've a couple of hours yet, and it's only a short drive back to house. Mel said, Tash, have you heard about the big conference the FIS is planning for the summer to debate global responses? Sure. England is putting in a strong bid to host it. Marlowe snorted. Of course we are. Thus the government starts scrambling over each other to secure a piece of whatever new world order emerges from this latest catastrophe. Well, you're being cynical. But that's not a bad thing, is it? Noel asked. That's sort of what happened through the climate crisis in the end. A new world order, as you put it. But a better order at the end than at the beginning. After much foot-dragging and foolishness and disputes. Maybe so. Oh, I suppose there are similarities. This blink is another global threat, demanding a global response. And for sure, the Earth's systems will take another beating. But otherwise, this is quite different. An existential event of a different character. And a different order of magnitude. Noel frowned. That's pretty alarming, if vague. But then I suppose it's your job to alarm us all. She smiled. I wouldn't say it's my job. Call it a perk. As far as I can see, it's not been so bad so far. Not here. I mean, a day of darkness that scared everybody half to death. Maybe we're tougher up north. Like a cloudy midwinter day for us. No worse than that. He looked up at she. I know there were casualties, but the worst after effects, so far, seemed to be those big storms in the southern oceans. Even they could be just seasonal, some are saying. Marlowe shook her head, decisive. I'll excuse your sloppy thinking, sir, since you are not my student, nor a journalist, nor a science influencer, or a politician, and you are serving my tea. But you are getting your news from idiots. You have to think it through, we all do. And to do that, you have to have a grasp of the numbers. We are still in the immediate aftermath of the blink, essentially. Look, we lost sunlight for a whole day, correct? That one day of our natural energy supply is equivalent to the energy output of our technological civilization over maybe 30 years. Surely you can see that it must have delivered a huge shock to the Earth's natural systems. To Tasha's relief, Noel responded to that mild put-down with a smile. An interruption in the flow. My wife was a plumber, Tasha's mother. She always said you don't want an interruption in the flow. Marlowe smiled. A plumber? Family business. They came over from Nigeria. Was running quite an enterprise when she died. I'm sorry. And Marlowe glanced at Mel. You lost her in 2039, you said. The pandemic. I suppose this is off topic, but Mel, I seem to remember you once told me you lost your father about that time. He had family in India, went back there during a famine, got killed in a separatist attack. And, she put in, I lost my father when I was young also. He was a soldier, drafted to fight in a border skirmish with Russia. Marlowe looked at them all. So is this what drew you lot together? I guess so, yes, Mel said. In part, anyhow. We met at college. We found we were all, well, half orphans. She and Tash were only children, and I have one brother, Paul, who studied theology and is now off in some kind of religious community in Oxford. I've hardly been in touch with him since our parents died. Totally different path to mine. Tash snorted. Brought together by our dodgy family backgrounds and a shared catastrophic lack of social skills. Marlowe nodded. There are worse bases for friendships. We never talk about this, Noel said gently. Family. Your mum. I'm sorry, honey. Oh, Dad. Tash leaned over and rubbed her father's back. Nothing to be sorry for. Never was, never will be. Anyhow, you did get it right, Marlowe said, smiling at Noel. He looked puzzled. Got what right? About the weather. In a cartoon way, about the storms. Interruptions in the flow of energy. So yes, on blink day, the warm summer air over the southern hemisphere cools down a bit, loses some moisture, rain mostly. And as it grows cooler and denser, accumulates in high-pressure systems, while it's snowing harder in the northern hemisphere winter. Then the sun rises once more, the energy pours in, the air suddenly warms up, the moisture evaporates, and in the south, everything's become unstable, especially over the ocean. So, storms, as we see now. With human misery as a consequence, Tash said, which is what's at the top of the politician's agenda for now. Marlowe seemed irritated by that, Tash thought. Of course it is, always the immediate, the short term. But these post-blink consequences should last only days, weeks, while the Earth's systems find their equilibrium again. Or a new equilibrium. It's going to be the longer-term effects that we really need to worry about, and not just the climate adjustments. Tash frowned, imagining Fred Bowles and the rest of the English government hearing this in an hour or two. Any heads up she got on this, the better. She asked gently, "Well, what longer-term effects, Charlie? What exactly?" And she spoke up. "Longer-term effects like this. Downloading." Tash quickly set up another wall to display his newsfeed. The smart surface picked up the data, magnified it. An image of the moon. Weeks after the full moon of the eclipse, this was a gibbous moon, more than half full and apparently a live image. Tash could just about make out the rest of the disk of the moon, a deep grey, lit up by the reflected light of the Earth. She knew that much at least. This image was set against a background of stars, the sunlit portion not bright enough to obscure them. Tash felt embarrassed to ask, "So, the moon, what are we meant to be seeing?" Two astronomers and one astronaut turned to her with evident surprise. Mel asked, "Can't you see it?" Noel patted Tash's hand. "Never mind, sweetie. I can't see it either. Just as well we've got the Astronomer Royal herself to explain it to us saps." Charlie grinned. "Okay, we deserved that. There's a couple of things, obvious at a glance. The darkened limb against the stars. That's not quite right. You can see more of the starry background than you should be able to, at this point in the moon's orbit." In her head, Tash tried to translate this into terms that Fred Bowles would understand. "Okay, and that's because the moon has moved? I mean, I know it orbits the Earth." "It's a little too far away," Mel said, taking pity on her. "The orbit has changed, so the visible disk is a bit smaller against the background stars." "And not just that," she said. "Look at the surface features. I'll enhance the earthshine so you can see it clearly." It was as if a bright beam shone on the shadowed portion of the moon's surface, in real life only dimly lit by reflected sunlight. And now the complete, familiar man-in-the-moon pattern emerged, Tash saw, a landscape of huge craters and seas of lava dust. Down there somehow, a handful of human artifacts, the old museum piece probes, the historic Apollo sites, the modern bases inhabited by multinational crews rotating down from the orbiting gateway station. All very familiar. But not quite, she saw as she looked more closely. There was the Mare Imbrium, the man's right eye. And he was looking away, as if his head had turned right a little. "Shit," she murmured, Sorry, Dad. The moon has... turned. Good, Marlowe said. You see it. Well done. Sorry to be patronising again, but you're right. The moon is a little further from the Earth than it was, and it's rotated on its axis, relative to the Earth. It always did wobble a little. Libration, we called it. But otherwise, that's the first time the moon has started to turn away from us for billions of years. Well, we expected this. The models predicted it. But I concede it's another thing to see it with your own eyes. This is to do with orbits, Tash said slowly. Isn't it? When the sun disappeared, its gravity switched off. And so the Almirich, on its way back from Mars to Earth, started to follow the wrong orbit home. But Mars and Earth, too. Followed the wrong orbits also, Marlowe said. Correct. And so they are back in orbit, but not in the same orbits as before, same as all the planets. And Earth's orbit is distorted. You understand that the Earth's orbit was never a perfect circle in the first place. It's an ellipse, slightly flattened off the circular. Or was. It's perihelion, the point when Earth comes closest to the sun, is in January, about now, the northern winter, a couple of weeks after the solstice, and the aphelion, the furthest, in July, in the middle of our northern summer. So our summers were always that bit cooler than the southern hemispheres. Well, now that ellipse has got more elliptical, we astronomers say the eccentricity of the orbit has increased. It's roughly doubled, in fact. The perihelion is the same distance at northern winter, but the aphelion is increased. That is, Earth will be further away from the sun during our summer. So those differential warming effects are going to be magnified. Colder summers in the north, harsher winters in the south. And, Noel said grimly, I bet we are all going to find out about the implications of that in the weeks and months to come, correct? As the climate systems try to adjust, as wind and rain patterns become scrambled, reaching for a new equilibrium, afraid so. Tash pointed. And the moon? That's more complicated, Mel said. The moon is in orbit around the Earth, so when the Earth went off course, the moon was dragged after it, but the multiple influences were complex. It's finished up in its own, new, more eccentric orbit around the Earth, Marlowe said grimly. Tash tried to think that through. Her father got there first. Tides, he said. That's going to muck up the tides. Correct, Marlowe said. The effects are already visible regarding the ocean tides. Well, those tides are meters high, easily measurable. But there are rock tides too. The moon's gravity and the sun's. Raised tides in the crust of the Earth a few centimeters high. The effects of that will take longer to work out, but they will come. Tash frowned. What effects? Mel shrugged. Landslips, earthquakes, even volcanic eruptions, possibly. Impulsively, it seemed, Noel grabbed for their hands, Tash, Mel. Tough times ahead, then. However all this works out. Tash smiled and squeezed back. Dad. Just have some pity on me as I try to help government ministers and civil servants understand all this. And more, she said abruptly from behind his screen. There is more you need to stress, Astronomer Royal. You must speak of agency to the governments. Convince them of it. Noel seemed alarmed. She? Agency? What do you mean? Mel squeezed his hand harder. He means this isn't a natural phenomenon, global and severe as it is. Not just a Chicxulub comet strike. Something did this to us. Or somebody. There is agency behind all this. And that's how we have to think of it. How we react. She said, of course this is nothing new. Professor Marlowe has been saying this from the earliest meetings. It's obvious, isn't it? And here in Houston I have been privileged with further data. Gathered elsewhere. Data I think you should ask to see before you speak to your ministers again. There was a tense silence. Tash nodded and murmured a command. Okay, she. The channel's still secure. The flat systems. I'm government, remember. They set me up with this in case I ever needed some kind of confidential briefing at home, and... Not me, though, Noel made to stand. If you lot have sensitive things to say to each other. Please stay, Charlie Marlowe said. I trust Mel, so I trust Tash, so I trust you. But actually, she is right. Some of us have been calling this out since Blink Day. The surgical precision of the removal of the sun, the eclipse timing. These are all hallmarks of intelligence, and signals aimed at intelligences on Earth, us. But somehow it is ignored, as if we dare not speak of it. I understand the need to avoid paranoia, even panic. But the sooner all this is out and understood and assimilated, not just by the scientists and politicians, but by the public, the sooner we will be able to handle it all. Collectively, I mean. Noel frowned. A being able to transport suns. Some first contact. I thought the theory was that advanced civilizations, advanced in technology and such, would be advanced ethically, too. That was always the dream. I remember the remake of Contact, what, in the 2030s, with that terrible avatar of Carl Sagan. They would come to help us, cherish us. Marlowe shrugged. They, or it, may be ethical, but in their own value system. We think it's ethical to eliminate viruses, don't we? We drive them to extinction if we can, influenza, the 2030s COVID strains, maybe to it. We're just viruses, Noel asked. That's a thought. Talk about Carl Sagan. He must be turning in his grave. And I suppose taking away the sun for a day isn't evidence of a kindly nature. Look, I do need to make some more tea. Fill me in, Tash. Tash felt numbed. She had put off thinking about this aspect of things. Above my pay grade. She was almost scared of what she might learn next. As her father bumbled out to the kitchen, she tried to hide her own anxiety. Look, we aren't completely in the dark, the Astronomer Royal said. There have been some speculation before, not about this event particularly, but about events of this kind, agents of this kind, of this scale. Theoretically, I mean. And if they exist, how intelligences might reshape the universe on huge scales. Tash frowned. You're talking about the... what was it? The Kardashev types. You brought that up on Blink Day. I had to check the stenographer's spelling. Marlowe nodded. In part, yes. That's a starting point, at least. Kardashev, Soviet Union. Scientist in the last century. A Kardashev Type 1 culture masters energy on a planetary scale, meaning all the sunlight that falls on it. So we aren't there, even not yet. A K2 masters energy on a stellar scale. All of a star's output, Dyson spheres, if you know what they are. And a K3 masters the energy output on the scale of all the stars in the galaxy, hundreds of billions of them. K3. Now, to move the sun, in an instant, let me remind myself of the numbers. Marlowe tapped at her phone on the tabletop before her, squinted a little at the screen. Okay, to move the sun, to teleport it, you would surely need to master energies equivalent to the mass energy of the sun. E equals mc squared, remember? 10 times the energy of the largest supernova explosions. So, Tash said cautiously, too big even for your... K3 culture? Well, I figure it would take a century or so of its energy budget, but it could be done. Noel came bustling back with the tea and a heap of biscuits, Tash saw, warm from the printer. K3, huh? Sounds like another Korean pop star. Sorry, I'll pour the tea. So, Tash said carefully, the entity we are dealing with, people are calling it Galaxius, she said. Here in Houston, anyhow. A name is a name. Nobody seems to know who coined it. Galaxius. We have named it. Even if all we know about it is that it can move the sun. Galaxius, said Marlowe softly. She swiped her phone. I ought to know about this. Here we are. Galaxius. Greek or Roman name for the Milky Way, as visible in the sky. named for the spilled milk of a goddess. Root of our word, galaxy, of course. Also the name of a type of fish, she said dryly. Fine, call it Galaxius. It needs a name. As long as we understand there's no implication of gender or motherhood, the label doesn't matter. But I do think we are dealing with a single entity here. Effectively. So a singular name, yes, it, not they. Monstrously powerful, but one entity. And yet it hides, even though it doesn't need to hide from us, surely. How do I know it hides? Because the galaxy looks unmodified. It is a galaxy-scale entity. It must be to master such energies as we have witnessed. Yet none of its works are visible. And it must have been able to stop anybody else building anything significant, too. Upstarts like humanity, perhaps. No Dyson spheres, anywhere. If such traces existed, we would have found them by now. This is why I believe it is a single entity, though I know some disagree. Because we see not a trace of it, or any vanquished rivals. We know it exists. It hides as a unity. It must be a unity. Mel pursed her lips. I should say this is pretty controversial. I suspect if you polled most scholars, even if they accepted the hypothesis of intelligence, they would argue for a strongly unified culture rather than a single entity. Marlowe shook her head. No. The control is too precise, too universal for that. Good grief, Null said. A single beast that moves suns. Maybe we should just build a whacking great temple and bow down and worship. No, Marlowe said sharply. I won't have language like that. Sorry, Null. Tash smiled ruefully. So you should be. I think you sometimes lack perspective, you scientists, you and Mel. You should see the polling that crosses Fred Bowles' desk. Right now, 50% of people seem to think this is an act of God. And I can testify to that. Every time I pop into the local church, it's packed out. Another 40% think it's all the fault of the government, or some secret cabal of scientists and oligarchs. Or the blink was something to do with a big Chinese spaceborne weather control project, which has been a popular meme for years. Only the final 10% think it's all scientific, astronomical. And even to them, a debate as to whether this Galaxius is a single entity or some kind of alien federation would be pretty abstruse. Mel said reluctantly. My own brother has been putting out posts about religious interpretations. Paul, the radical theologian. And he has been saying it's all an act of God, and we should be respectful. Marlowe looked aghast. Really? Your own brother? Did I ever meet him? Mel smiled thinly. No, you'd remember. He's a very clever, radical theologian, and can argue well. Marlowe snorted. Makes you wonder if humanity is worth saving at all. Then some of the energy ran out of her. I don't mean that, of course. It's just that sometimes one despairs. But anyhow, this is no God, Noel, yours or Brother Paul's, or otherwise. We know it's limited to light speed. Remember that. It has some proven limitations, at least. And as a material entity, it must need engines of some kind to have achieved this. Moving the sun, not miracles. We are looking for such engines, or their traces, in the vicinity of the sun, around the orbit of Mercury, for instance, and out in the direction of Centaurus, about where it put the sun. There is some flaky evidence. Various TNOs being deflected. She glanced at Noel, seeking understanding. Trans-Neptunian objects, comets and moonlets and dwarf planets. It's as if big masses have been assembled out there. Huge unseen engines, we think. The data is patchy. Things orbit slowly out there, and they are sparse. But the results we have so far are puzzling. But it's all technology, big, not miraculous. Since when did God need scaffolding? And anyhow, the biblical miracles were small fry in comparison to this. Even Joshua's miracle day, when the Earth's rotation was stopped, a K2, a star-scale culture, could have pulled that one off. A God? Puny Yahweh. Any tea left, Noel? But even as Noel went out to refresh the pot, Tash saw that she was distracted, looking away to something off screen. She, you okay? Fine, fine, just bending a few rules. Charlie, Mel, I hadn't realised how far you'd got in your thinking, but there's something else I have here. I wasn't sure it even existed. Now I am. I just got confirmation of access. Look, when you meet your ministers, there's something else you need to know about. If the Americans haven't done the decent thing and fessed up already, and they probably won't have. Mel shrugged. Nothing I've heard. Nor me, said Tash. Charlie glared. Get to the point. She said, I got a tip from some friends back home, China. Tash tried to puzzle that out. Your mother, who Tash knew was a senior space scientist in her own right, who, it had always seemed, had never had much contact with the son who had gone to the West to build his own career. He didn't reply. Mel said, never mind the provenance. Something else, she. What? Something else that might be connected to Galaxius, on the moon. There was a startled silence. Tash said, look, she, don't get yourself into any kind of trouble. I know about government security. I spend my life inside it. You're a hero astronaut, but that won't save you if... I know. And I'm sorry. I know I'm dragging you all into... indiscretion. But I saw a chance to get this stuff to you. I thought it was important. We should be sharing. Besides, there's no point being a tragic hero without leveraging it every now and again. A half smile. Tash and Mel shared a glance. That was a flash of the old Chi. Tash, set up your smart wall. Tash rebooted the wall with a soft command. The moon image, approaching fullness, was replaced by a shadowed hemisphere, its features only dimly visible. She said, the new moon around the moment of eclipse, lit by earthshine. But now Tash saw a spot near its centre was flashing on, off. So, Mel said, I take it we're back to blink day, right? Frowning, she stood and walked over to the wall. You're highlighting this feature? Tash asked, do you know what it is? Sure, every amateur astronomer does. Its location is the most significant thing about it. Or was. Now, with the whole lunar hemisphere out of whack, it's lost its title. What title? Tash asked. This is the Sinus Medii. Correct, she said. The central bay. Right at the centre of the moon's earthside face, as was. Jules Verne's Lunar Travellers saw it. Never mind. And it has some history. So I've been finding out. Yes, all right. Thanks to leaks from my mother, who has her own agenda, needless to say. Tash and Mel exchanged glances. Charlie Marlowe leaned forward to see better. The Americans landed a pre-Apollo spacecraft there, in the Sinus Medii. Surveyor 6, no crew, of course. This was back in the 1960s. They sent it there just by chance. They could have sent the probe anywhere on the surface. It was really just a technology testbed. NASA didn't report anything unusual about the mission. But it turns out that they, and successor agencies, have been quietly watching the site ever since, from lunar orbit, from telescopes on Earth and in space. And I learned since I got here, NASA even dropped a second probe there, a few years later, under cover of an Apollo mission, entirely covert. Tash glanced at Mel, wondering where the hell this was going. She went on. Well, the moon got more attention than usual even as blink day wore on, as it became obvious it was turning on its axis, relatively. Obvious to astronomers. And one American instrument, a lunar low orbiter, right at the end of the 24 hours, saw this. He tapped at, presumably, an out-of-shot phone. New images splashed on the smart wall. Evidently the moon again, but a landscape now. This was the scene just before the sun returned. Low-light imagery, basically you were seeing by earthshine. Tash saw what looked like an ordinary lunar scene, if you could ever call pictures beamed back from the moon ordinary. A rubble-strewn ground. Ellipses that must be foreshortened craters. The colours were odd, the ground greyish, the sky littered with stars, all of which would normally be drowned by sunlight in a lunar day, leaving only the Earth to be seen. But this wasn't like the usual human-touched lunar landscapes Tash was used to seeing. No Neil Armstrong footprints here, no habitats covered in radiation shield dust, just a low mound in the foreground, a heap of dirt. She said, "A deep lunar midnight at the Sinus Medii." But the visibility was good enough to pick up. 3, 2, 1. This. In that static scene, the sudden movement startled Tash. A projectile. A glittering pellet that was fired out of that innocent-looking mound of lunar dirt and went sailing into the sky, as if a small cannon had been fired right from the heart of the face of the moon. None of them spoke. Mel and Tash just stared, as the sequence was repeated twice, three times. A montage of images with explanatory overlays followed. There were multiple views, measurements made with multiple instruments, and multiple types of instruments Tash saw, including a spectrometer, which gave clues as to the composition of the projectile, which had just streaked away, a blur receding from sight. "Wow," Tash said. She watched their faces. "I'm not going to say a word, not yet. Let's pool our thinking," Marlowe asked quietly. "How big?" "That projectile." "About 0.5 meter across," she said, roughly spherical. Tash asked, "How long has that been up there? The mound, the artifact, whatever that fired that shot?" "Well, we can't know that." Mel said, "Okay, so we saw it by accident in 1967 through that surveyor." "Correct. The surveyor's photos had shown some kind of structure, visibly poking out of the dirt, a cylindrical hole cut in the top. Even the dust pile looked too symmetrical to be natural. Also, the Americans thought they saw evidence of ice inside that hole in the crest, maybe shadowed. Just a reflection. The surveyor had no sampling gear." "That's about all. Don't ask me more. All of this is classified, and I've seen little of it. As I said, the Americans sent up just one more lander, kept it quiet. Just watched for decades. Not an unwise policy, but the structure, whatever, can't have been doing anything but watch in return." "Watch what? Who?" "Given the location," Marlowe said dryly, "right at the centre of the Earth-facing hemisphere, I'd guess it's been watching Earth. Us." She nodded. "I think that's the best theory they have." "They being the American intelligence community, coordinating with some covert bits of the old NASA and its successor agencies, the probe runners. The old SETI theorists had a name for a probe like this. A lurker. It just sits and watches you, without revealing its existence. Anyhow, I only have partial information on this thing, all acquired since the blink. So I do know the US agencies have monitored this mound, this artifact, for decades. But now it's all hotting up." Tash frowned. "What do you mean?" "There's a Chinese team up there now. A human team. They were sent down from the Lunar Gateway after Blink Day, after presumably the American imagery of this firing event was hacked. The Chinese are running a lot of industrial projects on the moon, so they have plenty of infrastructure up there, a lot of cover, and much of it in Copernicus, a big, bright, nearside crater. Now a lot of them have moved into Medii. The Chinese are being very cautious, as you can imagine, and secretive. They have left the US probes alone. I mean the surveyor and the spy probe. They keep just out of its field of view. But they have also masked off the mound from the US probe's view." "What was it made of?" Tash asked. "The cannonball?" "Good question. As far as the Americans can tell from the spectrometry, ice. Just water ice. About 1 kilogram by mass, we think. A fat snowball. But it may have some kind of protective covering we can't see, to protect it at the speeds it seems to be going. There is a lot of dust in the plane of the solar system, although it's heading out of that plane." Marlowe was intensely interested in that. "What kind of speeds?" "As far as we could track it, It was still accelerating, hard, multiples of G. We don't know how it's propelled, by the way. No sign of fuel usage, no infrared signature. Nothing like a rocket exhaust or a sail. We don't know. We don't see any reason for it to slow anywhere short of light speed itself. By we, I mean the American analysts who are studying this thing. Tash shook her head. A bucket load of water ice. What's the point of that? I thought we were talking about a galactic intelligence. Marlowe said cautiously, we can only speculate. But Tash, you could store a lot of information in water if you chose. You yourself are pretty much a bag of water containing information coded into complex biomolecules. I'm not suggesting this system is using DNA itself, but the principle stands. Okay, said Tash, trying to think this through. But even if you could, theoretically, who would choose to send a message in water ice? Mel said, that's a better question. Maybe somebody to whom water is everything. We know that there are water worlds out there. I mean, exoplanets with nothing but deep ocean, no land breaking the surface. So maybe this is a clue as to the origin of Galaxias. If so, how exciting! Noel said evenly. But aren't you missing the point? Where was this sent to, do we know? She smiled. Another good question. Well, we don't know where it will end up, but we do know where it is heading, right now, for the constellation of Ophiuchus, north of Sagittarius, the zodiac constellation. If you go that way long enough, you would finish up above the center of the galaxy. Mel said, but it's not even traveling at light speed yet, correct? It would take millennia to get that far. Marlowe shook her head. Ophiuchus. I think I have an inkling. She dug out her phone. Catalogue, Ophiuchus. Barnard's star. She, can you download some better data on that missile's trajectory? With that projection, it took Marlowe only minutes to get the answer she apparently sought. Barnard's star, I knew it. The next system out beyond Alpha Centauri, nearly 6 light-years away. Tash asked, you're saying that's where the pellet is heading? Well, possibly, Marlowe said. When you factor in the relative motions of sun and star over the next few years, and a logical destination. But what's there waiting for it? Barnard's is a red dwarf with just one planet, as I recall. She frowned. Take a look, Mel said. But the system's very well studied. We shouldn't rely on anything we thought we knew before. Take a look. Find a recent observation. Marlowe nodded to Mel. Mel paged through data coming into her phone. Okay, not sure I see the point of this. There are frequent all-sky surveys that check out nearby star systems. Known exoplanets regularly. Let's see. Particularly, find out if there's anything new since Blink Day, she murmured into her phone again. When the results evidently came in seconds later, Mel looked puzzled, Tash saw. She tapped her phone, waved it at the wall, as if seeking a better signal. There is something, a new set of observations which... They've been flagged as anomalous. An instrument glitch, she shrugged, for what it's worth. On the smart wall, up came a blurry image of a star, and an even more blurred image of three planets of some kind. These are the best recent images I can find quickly. Taken a couple of days back, actually, with the L3T. That's She's own lodestone ludicrously large telescope in deep space. Marlowe got up, crossed to the wall image, and stared at it. Barnard's has one planet. She tapped the second planet icon, and the third. The images magnified. Tash saw fuzzy splashes, worlds with banded clouds like Jupiter or Saturn. Mel snapped unhappily. I know. If so, what the hell are these? Well, we thought Barnard's had only one planet, she said, paging through her phone. Turns out we were wrong, running some quick analyses. These two are about half the mass of Jupiter each. One is at asteroid belt distance from the star, the other not far in from where Jupiter would be. Oh, this is rubbish. These worlds can't exist. We should have seen them. We've been spotting exoplanets for decades. Oh, shit, she said. found an independent observation. Similarly, not believed. They're real, all right, Charlie. Missed by the automatics because, well, I suspect the AIs aren't trained to look for stuff like this. Planets appearing out of nowhere. They just read them as data anomalies. Tash said, my head is spinning. So what you're saying is that an alien cannon, hidden on the moon, spat a gob of water at alien planets that didn't even exist last month. I know, Mel said, sounding unhappy. On any other day, in any other year, that might seem strange. She said earnestly, Mel, widen your search. Nearby planetary systems. Find other recent anomalous observations. There's no reason why there should be just one. She glanced at Marlowe, who nodded. On it. But as she worked, she shook her head. Why? Why do it this way? Why conceal whole planets, if we haven't got everything wrong here? Maybe it's all about security, Tash said. Mel frowned. What about security? Sorry, government hack speaking. And Dad used to be a specialist consultant on cybersecurity for the Met. Noel nodded, cautiously listening. You get to think in these terms. It was when you were talking about concealment and so on, of the cannon and these planets. Also, I was wondering why anybody would communicate between the stars with chunks of water. Well, maybe that's the answer. Security. She looked at Mel, uncertainly. It makes sense, doesn't it? Even on a tight beam relay, the chance of some bad guy picking up a beamed signal is much higher than intercepting a small packet of ice. It's a low-tech way to do it, but it would be secure. That makes a lot of sense, yes, Marlowe said. Thank you. I didn't think of that. I wouldn't have thought of that. You are right, she. This is why we must share all we know. All of humanity, actually. It's the only way we are going to figure it out. Yes, it's a somewhat paranoid pattern that fits the observations. The moving of the sun was a huge stunt, obviously, and very visible. But aside from that, it's all been creeping around. An ice pellet message fired from a hidden station on the moon. Fired at cloaked planets. She nodded. This is the question. So who is Galaxis hiding from? Who does it need to hide from? Marlowe said, maybe nobody specific. It's solitary, as I said. It hides by reflex. Maybe waiting for some hypothetical threat. A threat like us, maybe. If we were to emerge. She pronounced the last word quite savagely. I found more, Mel said. What? Planets. She waved her hand over her phone, throwing more images on the wall. More planetary systems, Tash saw. Mel said, I ordered up a sweep of recent anomalous, to be confirmed or discarded observations of nearby systems. I suspect people are embarrassed by these data sets, and the academic journals will have trouble accepting them. She smiled grimly. Sometimes it's good to be able to name drop the Astronomer Royal. And you found something, she prompted her. I did. Only two more systems so far. The next out, beyond Barnard's, is Altair, in the constellation of the Eagle, about 17 light-years away. We thought it had no planets at all. Now it turns out it has 12, at least. More images. The outer six worlds were Jovians. The outermost, 100,000 times as far from Altair as Earth was from the Sun. Was so big it was technically a brown dwarf, halfway to a star. Of the inner planets, there are five Earth-like, or larger. The fourth planet, Altair E, I guess, is slap in the middle of the habitable zone, and maybe Earth-like. She actually smiled. You're confusing Tash, probably. Tash, think of Altair A as the star itself. So the first planet to be discovered is B, the second C. Mel shook her head. Anyhow, we saw none of these worlds before the blink. Marlowe seemed to be drinking in this information. And you said one more system? Another slide, more blurry worlds. This is 55 Cancri, in the constellation of Cancer. Actually a double star system. It has five planets. Well, we knew that already. But what's changed in this case is the fourth in terms of distance from the star, the fifth to be discovered. 55 Cancri F, formerly. It's called Harriet, after a long-dead astronomer. Half the mass of Saturn. Now we see it has a big moon. It looks oceanic. A big water world. Probably kept warm by tidal influences. We'd have spotted it before. So, Marlowe said, I think I see a pattern. There must have been a wave of unveilings, camouflage dropped, from as far out as 55 Cancri, at least. And this was all done years ago. So the images came heading in at light speed, the camouflage systems unmasked, from our point of view, one by one. Because presumably that concealment doesn't matter anymore. Or it wasn't going to matter anymore by the time these light speed images reached our telescopes, after blink day. And on the blink day itself, the installation on the moon fires off at least one message bundle back to the nearest station. Tash felt faintly disturbed. What does all this concealment say about the psychology of whatever it is we're dealing with? Mel frowned. Nothing good. She stared at 55 Cancri. How far away is this one? Mel didn't seem to hear. There may be more, masked stars. We need to report this to the international councils. Continue to check. How far away is 55 Cancri? This time she shouted his question. Shocked, Tash looked up. Hey, buddy, take it easy. How far? It's all right, Marlowe said, calm. It's hardly a secret. 41 light years, she. 41. Okay. She seemed to be thinking hard. His eyes scrunched closed. 41 light years, he muttered. Times two, light speed. Then he opened his eyes, looked around as if waking. I know. Tash longed to be able to hold him, or shake him. Know what? What do you know, she? Why it is here. Galaxias. Or at least, why it is here now. The timings all fit. Tash was bewildered, and Mel looked the same. She, the timings of what? Something we did, I think. He looked around again. I must talk to the people here, and NHSA. He stood, grabbed a jacket from a chair behind him. She, wait, don't go like this. There's probably little time. We can't waste any more of it. I... He seemed to run down. I'll be in touch. His image winked out. Tash was the first to break the silence. Wow, okay. So what's the plan? Mel, looking weary, just shrugged. I'll have to put together some kind of formal report on what we have found tonight. In your living room, Tash. Marlowe said, yes, we have to report this. Recommend further searches, analyses. Let's make a start. She reached for her phone. It's going to be a long night, Noel said, standing. I'll go put more tea on. Mel said, I wish I knew what she is thinking. He's just gone herring off again. If we knew what he was after, we could help him. Or stop him, Tash murmured. But, as it turned out, before the end of the month, Mel learned she would soon find herself travelling again, and this time, with Shea.